From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! A remarkable story of race and redemption in the New South. We'll speak with the best of enemies. He was a grand cyclops of the Ku Klux Klan. She, an African-American civil rights activist.
The night that I was initiated into the Klan was one of the most exciting moments of my life. It was a beautiful, thrilling, moving ceremony, and I had been longing for something for a long time. Now, that's, I'm not trying to make an excuse. I think I was ready for it and was there, and I was thrilled to be a member.
When I met Subverso CP, to my knowledge, now, he had been in council meetings where I had been before, standing up talking about he wanted to stop black folks from niggas from marching on the street. And that was during the time that I wanted to cut his head off. You know,
you'd taken a knife out at the city
council
meeting?
I was gonna kill him. I wanted to cut his head off because I felt like we had a chance to walk the street as well as anybody else did. We paid our taxes, and why couldn't we walk the street?
All that and more coming up on Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The 4th of July, the day the American colonies declared their independence from England in 1776. While many Americans will hang flags, join parades, watch fireworks, and wax patriotic, Independence Day is not a cause for celebration for all. For Native Americans, it is yet another bitter reminder of colonialism, which brought disease, violence, genocide, and destruction of their culture and way of life. For African Americans, Independence Day did not extend to them. While white colonists were declaring their freedom from the crown, that liberation was not shared with millions of Africans captured, beaten, separated from their families, and forced into brutal slavery thousands of miles away from home. Coming up, we'll hear the story of an amazing friendship between an exalted cyclops of the Ku Klux Klan and a black civil rights activist, a story that offers hope for healing in our racially divided nation. But first, we go back 140 years to one of the most powerful voices of the abolition movement, Frederick Douglass, born a slave in Maryland in 1818. As a young boy, Douglass was taught how to read by slaveholder Sophia Auld. It was a dangerous and radical act that changed his destiny. Douglass escaped from slavery in the 1830s and became a leader in the growing campaign against slavery through lectures and his anti-slavery newspaper, The North Star. On July 4, 1852, Douglass delivered one of his most powerful speeches against slavery in Rochester, New York. Here's an excerpt of a dramatic reading of the 4th of July oration by Frederick Douglass.
Fellow citizens, pardon me. Allow me to ask, why am I called upon to speak here today? What have I or those I represent to do with your national independence? Are the great principles of political freedom and of natural justice embodied in that Declaration of Independence extended to us? Am I therefore called upon to bring our humble offering to the national altar and to confess the benefits and express devout gratitude for the blessings resulting from your independence to us? But such is not the state of the case. I say it with a sad sense of disparity between us. I am not included within the pale of this glorious anniversary. Your high independence only reveals the immeasurable distance between us. The blessings in which you this day rejoice are not enjoyed in common. The rich inheritance of justice, liberty, prosperity, and independence bequeathed by your fathers is shared by you, not me. The sunlight that brought light and healing to you has brought stripes and death to me. This 4th of July is yours, not mine. You may rejoice. I must mourn. To drag a man in fetters into the grand illuminated temple of liberty and call upon him to join you in joyous anthems were inhuman mockery and sacrilegious irony. Do you mean, citizens, to mock me by asking me to speak today? If so, there is a parallel to your conduct. and let me warn you that it is dangerous to copy the example of a nation whose crimes, towering up to heaven, were thrown down by the breath of the Almighty, burying that nation in irrevocable ruin. I can today take up the plaintive lament of a peeled and woe-smitten people. By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down. Yea, we wept when we remembered Zion. We hung our harps upon the willows in the midst thereof. For there, they that carried us away captive required of us a song, and they who wasted us required of us mirth, saying, sing us one of the songs of Zion. How can we sing the Lord's song in a strange land? If I forget thee, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget her cunning. If I do not remember thee, let my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth. Fellow citizens, above your national tumultuous joy, I hear the mournful wail of millions whose chains, heavy and grievous yesterday, are today rendered more intolerable by the jubilee shouts that reach them. If I do forget, if I do not faithfully remember those bleeding children of sorrow this day, may my right hand forget her cunning, and may my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth. To forget them, to pass lightly over their wrongs, and to chime in with the popular theme would be treason most scandalous and shocking, and would make me a reproach before God and the world. My subject, then, fellow citizens, is American slavery. I shall see this day and its popular characteristics from the slave's point of view. Standing here, identified with the American bondsman, making his wrongs mine, I do not hesitate to declare with all my soul that the character and conduct of this nation never looked blacker to me than on this 4th of July. Whether we turn to the declarations of the past or to the professions of the present, the conduct of the nation seems equally hideous and revolting. America is false to the past, false to the present, and solemnly binds herself to be false to the future. Standing with God and the crushed and bleeding slave of this occasion, I will, in the name of humanity, which is outraged, in the name of liberty, which is feathered, in the name of the Constitution and the Bible, which are disregarded and trampled upon, dare to call into question and to denounce with all the emphasis I can command everything that serves to perpetuate slavery. The great sin and shame of America. But I fancy I hear some of my audience say, it is just in this circumstance that you and your brother abolitionists failed to make a favorable impression on the public mind. Would you argue more and denounce less? Would you persuade more and rebuke less? Your cause would be much more likely to succeed. But I submit, where all is plain, there is nothing to be argued. What point in the anti-slavery creed would you have me argue? On what branch of the subject do the people of this country need light? Must I undertake to prove that the slave is a man? That point is conceded already. Nobody doubts it. The slaveholders themselves acknowledge it in the enactment of laws for their government. They acknowledge it when they punish disobedience on the part of the slave. There are 72 crimes in the state of Virginia which, if committed by a black man, no matter how ignorant he be, subject him to the punishment of death, while only 2 of the same crimes will subject a white man to the like punishment. What is this but the acknowledgement that the slave is a moral, intellectual, and responsible being? There is not a man beneath the canopy of heaven that does not know that slavery is wrong for him. What? Am I to argue that it is wrong to make men brutes, to rob them of their liberty, to work them without wages, to keep them ignorant of their relations to their fellow men, to beat them with sticks, to flay their flesh with the lash, to load their limbs with irons, to hunt them with dogs, to sell them at auction, to sunder their families, to knock out their teeth, to burn their flesh, to starve them into obedience and submission to their masters? Must I argue that a system thus marked with blood and stained with pollution is wrong? No, I will not. At a time like this, scorching irony, not convincing argument is needed. Oh, had I the ability and could reach the nation's ear, I would today pour out a fiery stream of biting ridicule, blasting reproach, withering sarcasm, and stern rebuke. For it is not light that is needed, but fire. It is not the gentle shower, but thunder. We need the storm, the whirlwind, and the earthquake. The feeling of the nation must be quickened, and the conscience of the nation must be roused. The propriety of the nation must be startled. The hypocrisy of the nation must be exposed, and its crimes against God and man must be proclaimed and denounced. What to the American slave is your 4th of July? I answer, a day that reveals to him more than all other days in the year the gross injustice and cruelty of which he is the constant victim. To him, your celebration is a sham. Your boasted liberty and unholy license, your national greatness, swelling vanity, your sounds of rejoicing are empty and heartless, your denunciation of tyrants, brass-fronted impudence, your shouts of liberty and equality, hollow mockery, your prayers and hymns, your sermons and thanksgivings with all your religious parade and solemnity are to him mere bombast, fraud, deception, piety, and hypocrisy. A thin veil to cover up crimes which would disgrace a nation of savages. There is not a nation on the earth guilty of practices more shocking and bloody than are the people of the United States at this very hour. Go where you may, search where you will, roam through all the monarchies and despotisms of the old world. Travel through South America, search out every abuse, and when you have found the last, lay your facts by the side of the everyday practices of this nation. And you will say with me that for revolting barbarity and shameless hypocrisy, America reigns without a rival.
Frederick Douglass's 4th of July Oration, 1852, read by Bernard White of Pacifica Station WBAI in New York. And you're listening to Democracy Now!
I don't know how my mother walked her trouble down. I don't know how my father stood in.
Theirs is a profoundly American story, a story of racial hatred and redemption in the American South. It's a story of an unlikely friendship between black and white, an unbelievable relationship that formed at the height of the Civil Rights Movement and continues to this day. He was the exalted cyclops of the Ku Klux Klan in Durham, North Carolina. She was the leader of the United Organizations for Community Improvement, a militant black protest group. White racist C.P. Ellis and African-American activist Ann Atwater met during the battle over school desegregation, and they've been friends and allies ever since. Journalist Osha Gray Davidson tells their powerful story in his new book, The Best of Enemies, just nominated for the Pulitzer Prize. We'll hear from him in a little while, but first we turn to C.P. Ellis. C.P., why don't you tell us about where you grew up?
I, too, was born in the low-income white section of Durham. I lived on what we called as the white side of the railroad track, which was not too many miles from where I lived to where Ann was spent most of her life. We were, I guess we could be considered a low-income family. I remember as a youngster, black folks would come across the railroad track and go by my house, and they'd be going to a store, or service station, or something. And I guess, looking back, I felt suspicious of are afraid of black people even at a very, very early age. My father died at age 48. There was very little insurance. And we experienced some tough times financially. Then just shortly before my father died, I was married to a beautiful young lady named Mary Elizabeth Dixon. We lived in the booth. She moved in with us. We lived in the same house. I began to work around service station. Oh, let me back up. I quit school. I was between the 8th and 9th grade of school. I quit. I don't know for why. I think it was probably just because I couldn't absorb some of the things I was being taught. I think that was one of the problems. And I just got tired of going to school and wearing clothes that were ragged and not what I thought they ought to be. I probably had a lot of pride during those years. Shortly after we got married, we began to have children. Life was a real financial struggle as far back as I could remember.
How old were you when you got married?
18. My wife was 17. And we've been married 50 years, a little over 50 years now. It's typical Southern marriage. We've never been separated one night in our life. You know, I've been away from her working, but we've never been technically separated. Trying to pick up where I left off.
So you got married, and then you started to have kids.
Yeah, and we had our first kid was a girl, Vicky. She's married now. Second one was Kenny. Third one was Larry, better known to us as Punkin. Punkin is fortunate enough to have a child that was born to us blind, retarded, even though it really, really bothered me. Because, you know, I look back and I remember some things my dad told me at a very early age. He said, son, and he wouldn't say it in these exact words, but he would say it. He'd say, son, look, if you'll do right and you salute the flag and you obey the police and go to church and do right and good things will happen. And I remember that, and I remember it today very well. They used to tell me that we lived on Crane Street. And I began to question those values that he taught me. Good things were not happening. And I became extremely bitter. And I guess I had to have somebody to take it out on. I think the normal people was black people. When I would go downtown to a movie on Saturday, we'd have to walk from home to the movie. One of the first signs I'd see when I reached the downtown area was a sign that says colored only and whites only. That means colored folks went in one door and whites went in another door. And I remember very clearly quite trying to make sense out of that. I couldn't understand it. Why is it like this? And we'd go to the theater, get to the theater, and like one of them was Rialto Theater. You'd hear the black kids upstairs somewhere making a noise and playing, but you couldn't see them. So, and then the famous Royal Ice Cream Company on Mangum Street, a lot of people know about that. That was had separate. And I just questioned the whole philosophy. I couldn't make sense out of the fact that we had to live like that. I mean, I guess at a very early age, I was being primed for a membership in the Klan. I think I was probably destined to join the Klan.
C.P. Ellis is the former exalted Cyclops of the Ku Klux Klan in North Carolina. We'll continue our conversation with him, as well as black civil rights activist Ann Atwater, and the man who wrote their story, Osha Gray Davidson, in 60 seconds.
Hit 'em a little, hit 'em. Hit 'em, the water trouble down.
The Best of Enemies, Race and Redemption in the New South. That's the title of a book by journalist Osha Gray Davidson about C.P. Ellis, former exalted cyclops of the Ku Klux Klan of North Carolina, and Ann Atwater, an African-American civil rights activist. Both live in Durham, North Carolina. We'll go to them in a minute, but first, Osha Gray Davidson, can you put Durham in a historical context?
The context in which all of this happened, you really have to look back a little ways. Durham was a unique city, and it built itself as a unique city. It even, in 1913, erected this great sign that they put downtown with thousands of colored lights that said, Durham, renowned the world around, progress, wealth, success, health. And it was billed as the capital, the jewel of the New South, and then later on, the capital of the black middle class. And that's because of the presence there of the North Carolina Mutual Insurance Company, which was, at the time and for quite a long time, the largest black-owned business in America and in the world. It was known for having good race relations. That was spread throughout the South, that idea, and it was a magnet for blacks. The problem was that Durham never really lived up to that kind of public relations campaign, because even though the North Carolina Mutual did provide a great avenue to success for many blacks, it was a certain stratum of blacks, and the managers at Durham were college educated, so it was an elite group. And not to criticize many of the people at North Carolina Mutual, it's just the fact it was the nature of the institution that the benefits from North Carolina Mutual never really went that far beyond the insurance company. Now, they did make loans for houses for many blacks in Durham, but the need was so great. And people like Ann, who are poor, living in Hayti, really didn't feel any of the benefits that came from North Carolina Mutual. So that's the black side of the equation. On the white side, textile mill workers like CP's father had been exploited by mill workers for decades. First came tobacco, and the textile mill industry was an offshoot of that and eventually became the major employer in Durham. Mill workers were paid terribly low wages for awfully hard work, long working days, and very dangerous work. CP's father's death at 48 was attributed by the doctors to a heart attack, but as CP has told me, and I learned anyway, brown lung disease hadn't been diagnosed then, and that's more likely what happened from years of breathing in cotton dust. CP's father, like many white textile mill workers, died very young from these jobs. But they lived separate from the black community, right across the railroad tracks, as CP said, and instead of protesting against the white elite that ruled down in Durham, they had a convenient scapegoat in the blacks just across the railroad track. And the South has a long history of using race as a way to cover up class. And it worked with CP's father, and it worked with CP, and it works with lots of people, because skin color is such an obvious difference. And the Klan that CP joined, which had been demonized as a cracker, redneck organization of violent, poor whites, was originally founded by the white elite in the South and was always used by the white elite to do its dirty work. This way, the people, the powers that be in Durham, didn't have to dirty their hands. They could have CP do the dirty work for them.
CP, when did you join the Klan? How old were you?
I was middle to early 60s. It was sometime during the Howard Johnson boycott in Durham, North Carolina. I think it was sometime during that area.
Was your father involved with the Klan?
Yes, he was.
Did he encourage you to get involved?
Well, yes, he did. He would talked to me privately about that. I don't know, you know, why he was so secretive about it, but I guess that was the way it had to be during those days. But well, you know, the fact that he would tell me, do right, Sluk Fagin, and do what I tell you, and good things will happen. And then he would brag to me about the organization he thought would probably save Dixie one of these years. And I'd say, from what? And he'd tell me. He said he would say, from niggers. And that's the word he used to describe them. And, you know, that's about all I heard at an early age, and I think I was just destined to become a member of the Klan.
Do you remember your first Klan meeting?
Yeah, very, very well. That's a meeting that I was initiated in. It was, let me back up just a second, if you will. I think that and I don't want to blame things on anybody or anything, but a lot of the heartaches that we experienced, my wife and I experienced, I drove me to the Klan. I was looking for something as a young fella. I wanted to have something to say about what was going on around me, and really a person in the East Sector of Durham didn't have any organization he could join. And I guess at the right time in life, the Klan was there for me, and I joined. Let me say that up until that point, the night that I was initiated into the Klan was one of the most exciting moments of my life. It was a beautiful, thrilling, moving ceremony, and I had been longing for something for a long time. Now, I'm not trying to make an excuse. I think I was ready for it and was there, and I was thrilled to be a member, and that was in the early 60s. I had already previously filled out an application. I'd been to an outdoor rally, and I filled out an application and waited to hear from the application, and eventually I heard from a group of Klansmen who came by the station and told me that I had been approved, and they were ready to pick me up next week and take me for initiation ceremony. And I guess for the whole week I was anxiously waiting to be picked up to carry to the Klan meeting. And they picked me up, they carried me in the Klan hall into what we called an outer den, and there where we were given some instructions, we were asked questions, and a lot of different things were talked about. Nothing, no violence was talked about. It was just we talked about the Klan order. And then eventually, this is the ceremony that I described as being very beautiful. Eventually, they led me out of this outer room into an auditorium that was filled with people. The only light in that room was an illuminated red cross made out of fluorescent lights. I went through this initiation, part of initiation ceremony before I approached the cross. And eventually we were led up to the cross, told to kneel on our right knee, and that's when Exalted Cyclops began the initiation ceremony. But I left there a proud person because I finally felt like I belonged somewhere. And I went home and I rejoiced with my wife and Vicky. And I decided, after being in the Klan for a while, we were first appointed the chaplain. I didn't like the way things were conducted. It was too secretive. You need to keep in mind at that point, and now, I'd never been convicted of anything in my life. I paid taxes, cussed, cried, and prayed, cut grass like everybody else in Durham County did, and I felt like I had a constitutional right to be a member of it, and I did. And so I decided at one point, finally, after I became chaplain, I was asked to accept the position of Exalted Cyclops, which is president of a local chapter. And shortly after I became president, we began to visit politicians. We began to see merchants. We began to talk to them. And finally, I had made up my mind that I was tired of hiding. I was not going to meet anymore in a Clavin Hall. And I was going downtown where the action was at. I wanted to go to see where the city council was at, where the county commission was at, where the school board was at, where the housing authority people were at, and voice our opposition to some of the things that were going on.
Why don't we turn now to Ann Atwater? As C.P. Ellis was joining the Klan, what were you doing, and were you aware of the presence of the Klan?
Sure, I was aware of the Klans, because at my hometown, the Klansman, the mailman, we had a mail carrier that would stop by a lady's house, and they caught up with him stopping by the lady's house, so they, you know, they put him to the stake and burned him. And
he was black, she was white?
Yes, and so they killed him there, and everybody was afraid. When you said the word Klansman, you know, everybody was scared to death. They didn't know what. So I was aware of them, but I had never really got involved, you know, where I knew that I was near a Klansman. What I was doing during the time that CP was in the Klan, I guess I was running around trying to make ends meet, you know, trying to figure out how to go from one day to the other, because, like I said, I didn't know anything about it. We were working, you know, trying to train people how to be able to solve problems. I know at one time, after we got started in organizing the neighborhood councils in the community, we had some 23 neighborhood councils. I used to go downtown to the city council meeting, and they had a meeting which was called Committee of the Whole, which met on Thursday. There was one man, president of the bank, his name was John Wheeler. So anything that they wanted, they thought that the black folks wanted or needed, they would go to John Wheeler, and he would tell them, well, you could just pave this street. This is enough for right now. And that's the only street would get paved in our neighborhood. So he was just like a god. You know, they looked at him as God for the black folk.
Was he black?
He was black. But so after working with Howard Fuller and learning how to do things, we decided, and this organization that he was chairman of was the Durham Committee on the Affairs of Black People. After we found out, you know, what was going on, we decided that we would go in and try to get a new chairman of that committee in order to help black people. Well, they would tell us to come to the meeting at 7 o'clock. When we arrived, they had already elected officers at 6:30. So we started trying to play their game. Finally, at last, we got in and we put some new faces in. Well, it wasn't long after that before Mr. Wheeler died. And I'm not saying good, but it did change a lot of people's way of thinking, you know, after he passed on.
Do you remember the first time you met C.P. Ellis?
Yes. We were in a meeting. The AFL-CIO had a grant, and they were getting ready to integrate our school system. And
The union.
Yeah. They told me to go out in the community and get some low-income people and bring them to the meeting. That Tuesday night, I had a van load, and we went to the Y, and that's when I first saw C.P., to my knowledge of seeing him. Now, he had been in council meetings where I had been before, standing up talking about he wanted to stop black folks from marching on the street. And that was during the time that I wanted to cut his head off. You know, I was there. It wasn't too many of our people there that night, but I happened to be there. And one of the councilmen came to me and told me, said, that's what they want you to do something to get yourself in trouble. They want you off the street. And this will really put you off the street if you do that. So I folded my knife up, put it back in my pocketbook. And so
you'd taken a knife out at the city
council
meeting?
I was going to kill him. I wanted to cut his head off, because I felt like we had a chance to walk the street as well as anybody else did. We paid our taxes, and why couldn't we walk the street? So, and you know, he would be on the street when we would have marching. He'd be on the other side, but I didn't know that was CP. See, he was just somebody that I saw. But when I really got to know who he was at the meeting at the Y. And when he was jumping up talking about these niggas and you know, this and that about the niggas, I would call him a cracker. And it boiled on down to, it looked like we weren't going to get quiet enough to do nothing, no good in the meeting. So they decided that we needed to break from that place and set up what they call a charrette. And then they asked CP to be co-chair and asked me, and I told him no, I didn't want to be co-chair with no Klansmen. I wasn't going to work with no Klansmen. But then I thought about it, that the newspaper would print, "Blacks afraid of whites." And I said, I can't read that in the morning when I get up. So I called the paper back and told them that I would be happy to co-chair the meeting. And we started off from that. We started by having supper. Well, I call it, some people call it dinner. I call it supper. The next afternoon, down at S&W Cafeteria in Durham, you would find that that's where the police department is now. And I think we must have christened it real good for the police to move in there. So,
did you sit down at the same table?
He didn't want to at first, but I agreed with him. If he would go ahead and let's work on the school issue, when this finished, if he felt like it was a black and white issue, then we would do that. So he sat down and we ate dinner together. And then we moved on. By that time, we had scheduled the meetings at R.N. Harris School. And when I got up on R.N. Harris School for the meeting that morning, he was showing our mayor at that time in the trunk of his car. And I didn't know what he was showing him, but when I got there, I always called it a machine gun, but he said it was a different type of gun. And I had my little white Bible in my hand. And so I told him as we got in the building, we would see which God, whose God was the strongest, mine or his. And I'm happy today to say that I believe my God, as a matter of fact, I know my God was the strongest, because we have gotten to be real good friends. And we, at that time, we learned that we needed each other. And because he was having the same problems as I was with his son, as I was with my daughter in school. And we both didn't know that in the beginning. But when we found that out, we struck out then trying to save our children, save the school, you know, get more material, the right type of material for our children to study in school. And we began to stop fighting each other and fighting the problem. And that's, you know, how we got to be, and we are still tight.
C.P. Ellis, at that dinner where you and Ann met, had you ever eaten with a black person?
I can't remember ever being that. No, I'm sure I hadn't. You know, the closest I ever got was on the street somewhere, but not sit down to the table, even looking across the table at a black person.
Let me go over to Osha Gray Davidson, again, author of The Best of Enemies, Race and Redemption in the New South, who profiles these two people, C.P. Ellis and Ann Atwater, and profiles their lives and how they met and what happened afterwards. Again, if you could lay out for us the context of the time.
This was a time of great turmoil, obviously, turmoil between the races. One thing that struck me about this period, when C.P., when I was visiting down in Durham doing research, C.P. and I would drive around Durham for a few hours each day, and just C.P. would fill me in on the story of his life. And he'd point out, oh yeah, there's the bank, and he pointed to the most prestigious bank in Durham. He said, there's the bank that gave us the loan to build the Clavering Hall. And then he'd say, and here's the police station where they'd call me from when blacks would take out a permit for a demonstration for all the marches in Durham at that during that period. And they'd call and let me know where the march was going so I'd know the route. And here's the section where we received phone calls from, this is the upper class, and this is the section that we received money from, donations from, but always in secret. And it became very quickly evident that although the Klan drew its membership from working-class whites, it received its support in large part from upper-class whites. And C.P. had mentioned that he went before the city council and spoke. What he didn't mention was how some city council members would call afterwards and say, boy, we're glad to have you come to these meetings and express the point, this point of view, because this is the kind of point of view we can't express ourselves. But so there's this infrastructure, the elite infrastructure of Durham, that depended on CP to, as I said earlier, to do the dirty work. But there were demonstrations going on throughout this time. There was even a little earlier the lunch counter movement that began in Greensboro but became a national movement in Durham. And it was a period of great racial strife and turmoil. And the program that brought CP and Ann together, it was to desegregate the schools in a nonviolent way. And as C.P. pointed out, he went to it reluctantly with no intention of trying to desegregate the schools. But I also think it's important to understand that what schools we're talking about are the inner city, what would be called the inner city schools, the public schools in inside of Durham, attended by both black and white students, but by working class students. This was the period of white flight, when wealthier whites could move out to the suburbs or send their kids to segregation academies, all white private schools.
What did the union, the AFL-CIO, what did it have to do with the integration of the schools?
Well, the money was funneled through the union from the Nixon administration, and Nixon ran, obviously, in 68, his southern strategy to divide the South, but at the same time had to deal with, as president, the inevitability of desegregation within the public school system. I mean, Brown v. Board happened in 1954, and yet the schools were still segregated. Most schools were still segregated. The schools in downtown Durham that were that did have blacks and whites in them had a lot of problems with violence. And so these problems were addressed through a certain amount of money funneled from HUD, given to the AFL-CIO as just one of many groups to try and come up with solutions to this. And this was a union-based program in order to help schools desegregate and also to fight the violence within the
schools.
And
this was what, in the year 1970?
1971.
Osha Gray Davidson, author of The Best of Enemies, Race and Redemption in the New South, will continue with C.P. Ellis and Ann Atwater in a minute.
My God calls to me in the morning.
This is Democracy Now!, where citizen action matters most. I'm Amy Goodman, and we continue our conversation with former Klansman C.P. Ellis and black civil rights activist Ann Atwater, both of Durham, North Carolina. Now, you've both told us the story of how you met, but C.P., over those 10 days when you were co-chairs of the committee looking into desegregating the schools, can you talk a little more about your transformation?
You know, one of the important issues to me is what happened during the school program. Ann and I was working together because I still had some real hang-ups. But day after day after day, we talked about problems. We listened to other people's problems. It was our responsibility to carry that program on because we were elected as co-chair. And I just decided I was going to do what I could. And we worked together and we talked together. We talked about problems that we'd had and our kids. And really, during those 10 days, well, more than 10 days, really, it became abundantly clear to me that Ann Atwater and myself had a lot of identical problems. And before the school program was over, I was beginning to feel very comfortable in Ann's presence.
Now,
we were very close together.
You were Exalted Cyclops at the time, is that right?
Oh, yes, I was still Exalted Cyclops. And after the 10 days was over, they decided to have a little celebration at the motel downtown, a dance, and I agreed to go up there, and we had a crowd of people there. Ann was up there and some other people up there. People who worked in that charrette were going to have some celebration. The music was playing. We were talking. I was on one side of the dance hall. Ann's on the other side of the dance hall, and I looked up, and here come a black guy across the floor. I knew his Ann's boyfriend, and he said, "Miss Dallas." I said, "Yes." He said, "Ann would like to dance with you." I said, "Oh my God, that's just a little bit too quick." And the television cameras were there, and people were ready to take pictures. And I just said, "I'm sorry, I can't do it."
It was a night to remember, I tell you that, because he was scared to death. He wouldn't dare budge. But I'd always be willing, you know, to try anything.
But somebody, Ann, recommended that we at least meet in the middle of the floor and toast one another. So I said, well, I can do that. So we met in the floor, and we toasted one another. And, you know, we've been sort of toasting one another ever since, I guess, for 25 years, because we're friends. And I found out, you know, and this nation needs this. We need one another. We don't need to fight one another, especially working class and poor and low-income whites and blacks. We need one another. And what Ann and I are trying to do is get people to understand this. And a lot of people say, well, hell, you crazy. You know, look where you were. That's right. That's where I were, but that's not where I'm at now.
Well, let me ask you, C.P. Ellis.
Yes.
You were, at that time, exalted cyclops of the Ku Klux Klan in Durham, North Carolina. When did you leave it?
Shortly after the meeting was over, I went home, and the next day I called a friend of mine who was a vice president of the Klan group in Durham and told him to come by the house. And he came by the house, and I said, Bobby, I just, you know, I hate to tell you, but I don't need the Klan anymore. You know, I can't fight anymore because I don't know what to fight. I don't have those enemies that I had at one time. So I won't be coming back. When you turn the keys in, he said, I understand, CP, thank you. And that I haven't been back, and they haven't bothered me. They called and threatened, and we're going to kill them and all that stuff. But, you know, I pretty well take care of myself. But I had no need for it. The hatred was gone. The bitterness was gone. The hang-ups, there were some hang-ups there, but it was all gone.
What about your wife? I mean, she stood with you when you joined the Klan. How did she feel as your feelings were changing about blacks?
She was typical Southern. She's just done what her husband done. Sometime, not all the time. No, she was really glad it was over, I think, because I missed a lot of time. I should have been spending with her and our son that was blind retarded. She had spent, when I was out running all over North Carolina to Klan rallies, she was at home trying to look after this child. And I come home one night, I think just before before that charrette started, and I walked in the house and she was on the bed laying face to face with our boy, and she was pinned, had a large pin tied to her and to our son. And I said, honey, what do you got that pen for? She said, I use that pen so that when he gets up, that I'll know he got up. And I'll wake up. She said, if I don't, he'll get up and hurt himself, and I'm asleep. So, you know, that thing really dug at me for a long time. And that may have been the issue that really started some change in my life.
I wanted to say CP was changed before he got home, before the 10 days was over. Because we had some singing, gospel singing. The first week, he started patting his feet. But the second week, he was clapping his hand and patting his feet. I think for a little more, he would have got up and shouted. So I think God had changed him even before the meeting was over.
A lot of people call it religious conversion, and I don't describe it as that. I thought when I was in the Klan, I'd been ordained of God to stop integration. So, but anyhow, it happened, and we all feel very good about it.
What did you say to your kids when you started to change?
It was very, very difficult for me to explain it to them. But I just told them it was over. And see, at that point in time, we had a youth corps organized. A good, strong young people going to school was organized, a member of the youth corps. It hurt to have the young kids call and say, Mr. Ellis, when are you coming back? See, what do you tell young kids when you've had them for several years and you've taught them all the evils of integration and the evils of and Martin Luther King and David Abernathy and all the others was communists, and we had taught them not to socialize with the black kids in the school. They said, we have social hours, and teachers said, we have to do it. I said, no, don't. Go out in the hall. Don't go. And what do you, you know, I told them, and they're doing exactly what I told them. And then all of a sudden, after 10 or 15 days in the program, I come back, and I left the Klan and left them, nobody to take over, nobody to work with them. And they'd say, when are you coming back, Mr. Ellis? And that really got to me. In fact, the following months, the months that followed, I went through some real soul searching, trying to find out something. Why did I do what I done? And how? Why did I get in the Klan to start with? And that's another story. I think there are reasons people join those organizations. But
the main reasons?
Well, let me say this. I don't know whether you're familiar with this or not, but I was eventually, after I left the Klan, I was elected the business agent of a pretty good-sized labor union. And then eventually I was elected business manager. And during those periods that I worked as business manager and labor and business agent and business manager, I had opportunity to visit the homes of white and black workers who wanted unions, who would call us and say, come help us organize. And I would respond and go check in the motel and be in town and begin to talk to them. Then I'd visit with some of the people who wanted to be organized. And I've been in home after home after home of black people and white people. And let me give you a little example that I always use, and it's true. I'd visit, say, on Friday afternoon. You know, Friday was payday. And I'd go in, and I'd see the family around the table, maybe a six-pack check on the table. And this is what I saw. This guy had worked all week, 40 hours, maybe 48, some little time there. And he comes home on Friday afternoon, he stops by the store and gets a six-pack. He wants to dull the weekend. But this is what you would hear the guy saying. As I worked a whole week. I made 40 hours, and some of them made 48 hours. And I'd look at my paycheck, and I'd look at the bills, and I'd look at my family, and there wasn't enough there. And I'm frustrated, and I got mad, and I got drunk, and I fought, and I raised sin. See, people do things sometimes because they're pushed into it. And what we need to do is understand that and work with people and try to bring them out of it.
You see, Pete, reading at the end of the book, Osher writes about you being plagued by guilt for selling out the poor white community and that it led to your committing yourself to a psychiatric ward.
That's true. After I left, the guilt and the isolation and rejection from the people in the community. I mean, people I've been knowing all my life wouldn't speak, wouldn't look. They'd let me know they didn't want me to even come to the grocery store, the service station, where they're at. I mean, they just simply wouldn't scream it out, but they'd just ignore you. And that began to really worry me. And a lot of the things that I felt guilty about the Youth Corps people. And I eventually I just decided that I had to have some help. And this was on Christmas Eve. The day before Christmas Eve, that I had been drinking. My first response when I would have problems was to drink. Go home and go back to the bedroom and drink and try to call those Klansmen and see if they would take me back. And they weren't about to. But the isolation and rejection and the guilt was killing me. And one night before Christmas Eve, the next morning, I got up. Let me back up. Before I went to bed, I was sitting at the dining room table with my wife, and I just simply did not want to live. I took a 16-ounce Pepsi Cola bottle, which was solid glass, not plastic, and crushed it over my head. And I'm not proud of it, but I've done it. That's part of my life. And so I went to bed. Well, immediately my wife got up and got a towel and wiped the blood off. And I went to bed and went to sleep. The next morning, I got up. I packed my clothes, and my wife said, where are you going? I said, honey, I'm going to get some help. I can't stand it. I can't live. My kids, playing under the Christmas tree that morning early. They said, where are you going, Daddy? I said, I got to go get some help. So I went out to John Upson Hospital in the area and told them what was going on. Never been there before, and I said, I need some help. They examined me, says, okay, we agree, and they admitted me. And I began the road to recovery there that very night. The next day when I checked myself into the hospital, I began a road of recovery.
Well, what an amazing story, and it's certainly one that continues to evolve. C.P. Ellis, former, and it's hard to say this, exalted cyclops of the Ku Klux Klan of North Carolina, and Ann Atwater, African-American civil rights activists. Both are from Durham. And the story of their friendship is written in this new book by journalist Osha Gray Davidson. It's called The Best of Enemies, Race and Redemption in the New South. The publisher is Scribner. If you'd like to purchase a copy of today's program, you can call our archives at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin with help from Erica Martinez. Our engineer is Kenneth Mason. Special thanks to Lou Hankins, Bill Wax, Errol Maitland, and Bernard White, and to KSUI in Iowa City and WUNC of Chapel Hill in North Carolina. You've been listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. We go out with the social satire of Richard Pryor.
Y'all know how black humor started. It started in the slave ships, you know. Cat was always where we were rowing. You know, the dude said, what you laughing about, man? So yesterday I was a king. Having a bicentennial for 200 years. Gonna have a bicentennial, nigga. They will. They have some nigga 200 years old in blackface with stars and stripes on his forehead. Eyes, lips just as shiny. And he'll have that lovely white folks expression on his face. But he's happy. He's happy because he's been here 200 years. Said, I'm just so thrilled to be here. Over here in America, I'm so glad y'all took me out of die, homie. I used to live to be 150. Now I die of high blood pressure by the time I'm 52. And that thrills me to death. I'm just so pleased America's gonna last. They brought me over here in a boat. There's 400 of us come over here. 360 of us died on the way over here. I love that. That just thrilled me so. I don't know, you white folks are just so good to us. Got over here, another 20 of us died from disease. but you didn't have no doctors to take care of us. I'm so sorry you didn't. Upset you all some too, didn't it? Then they split us all up. Yes, sir, we took my mom over that way, took my wife that way, took my kids over yonder. I'm just so happy. I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do if I don't get 200 more years of this. Lord of mercy. Yes, sir. I don't know where my old mama is now. She up yonder in that big white folks in the sky. Y'all probably done forgot about it. But I ain't gonna never forget it.